We're delighted to welcome with us today Badger High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Are there Washington High School students here with us? They would stand. I think they have not yet arrived. The high school students are here with the Wisconsin Supreme Court and State Bar National Award-winning program called Court with Class. We invite high school students across the state to join us for an oral argument. They're sent the briefs, and they may engage in various activities in their schools concerning the case you're about to hear. And as part of that program, the students meet after the second oral argument at about 12:15 with a justice of this court. And today, that justice is Justice Patricia Patience Robinsack, who is on the far right of the bench. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her left, Justice David Prosser, and on the far left, Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, I will call our first case today, 03-1234 CR, State versus Michael D. Sykes. Arguing on behalf of the defendant, Michael D. Sykes, is Jeff DeLaRosa. Mr. DeLaRosa.
Good morning, Chief Justice and members of the court. Good morning. My name is Jeff DeLaRosa, and I'm here on behalf of the defendant, appellant petitioner Michael Sykes, and may it please the court. I'm here this morning to request that the appellate court's unpublished decision in the present matter be reversed for three primary factors. One, that the appellate court's decision wildly strays from both historical doctrine of search incident to arrest, as well as our current understanding of that concept and that Fourth Amendment exception. There are serious citizen and public policy considerations whereby the court's opinion should be overturned, and also that I believe that the court's finding of probable cause to arrest for criminal trespass is unfounded by the facts contained in the record and doesn't meet with the law, the elements of criminal trespass. With the court's indulgence, I'll first turn to why the appellate court's decision strays from the search incident to arrest doctrine. And it's been called the oldest exception to the Fourth Amendment. And if, with the court's indulgence, I will turn to a text that I use in preparation for today and read a quick synopsis of what I believe that the author of the text, Professor William Greenhalgh, in his Fourth Amendment handbook, states. And he writes as follows: "Search incident to a lawful arrest is the granddaddy of all exceptions coming to us from English common law. The predicate for the initial intrusion is easy. It is the fact of a lawful arrest. There is no such creature as a search incident to an unlawful arrest or a search incident to a non-arrest." And for the most part, that summarizes my position here today. If we look at United States versus Robinson, a U.S. Supreme Court case, it goes through a fairly lengthy history of the search incident to arrest exception.
Counselor, if Mr. Sykes had been arrested for criminal trespass in addition to possession, would your argument still hold up, or would you be satisfied that the search was incident to a lawful arrest?
No. My arguments today would be the same, although I think there would be more an emphasis on whether there was probable cause to have him arrested for criminal trespass.
Okay, that's a different. I want to put that aside, and I know that was one of the three factors you said that the lower court should be overturned for. But let's put that aside and assume there's probable cause. If, in fact, he had been arrested for both of the crimes, then the argument you make to us wouldn't have validity, would it?
That would be correct. I think if there were probable cause.
Okay, so now let's say he's arrested for both, but prosecutor looks at him and decides to only charge him with possession. So he got arrested for both. Prosecutor just decides he's only going to proceed on one because maybe there's a few problems with trying to prove the criminal trespass. Where does that put your argument?
I think we might be in a different situation and maybe not be here today, in all honesty. And that's assuming that probable cause to arrest for criminal trespass was there, which is, of course, one of the things that we're disagreeing with. But I think you're essentially correct.
Okay. All right. So just so I understand where you are. Thank
Counsel,
you.
Counsel, just from a factual standpoint, I just want to, so that I have this down, basically, and I won't go through all the facts, but when the officer entered the room and he saw these people, nobody in that room had any expectation of privacy. Am I correct at that time? In other words, these people, and I don't want to go through all the facts, none of them were holding any expectation because they weren't supposed to be there. Is that an overstatement?
Well, somewhat. I think that all of the people present probably had an expectation of privacy. I would phrase it as, I don't think it's one that our society would recognize as reasonable.
But they were in a apartment that they had no ownership. They weren't invited there. In fact, they were up there to change the locks, and that's how the police happened to come in the first place, right?
Well, the underlying rationale for changing the locks were some vague reports to the landlord of suspicious activity. There wasn't anything specific to Mr. Sykes in the information presented to the landlord. And though the renter of the apartment, Stacy Hudson, at the motion hearing providing our record, testifies yes. that Mr. Sykes did not have consent from her to be there, that information was not presented to law enforcement and from any source at the time they made the entry into the apartment and the search of the wallet.
Mr. Villarosa, was there any of the people who were in the apartment when the police came, were any of those individuals the two individuals that Ms. Sykes had given a key to?
No, not that I'm aware of.
No. Mr. De La Rosa, is there a temporal aspect to your argument? In other words, are you arguing that you first have to arrest before there can be a search incident to the arrest, or do you think that that's something that can occur first the search and then a formal arrest?
Well, my assertion in that respect is that I think some of our recent jurisprudence in regards to search incident to arrest has strayed from, I think, the true historical notions of the doctrine. As first announced in Weeks versus United States, throughout English common law and through our early history, the search always was subsequent to the arrest. And that's, I think, what the true doctrine is. However, when we see Rawlings versus Kentucky and the cases it relies on, Bailey being one from the Washington, D.C. Appellate Circuit, and I have the site if the court needs it, but we start to see the movement away from the arrest and then the search. We start having contemporaneous searches, and we start having the allowance of search preceding arrest. So I guess the argument can be made that the current state is that you can have a search prior to arrest, but having it close in time is still a necessary element. But that goes to reasonableness of the search once it has occurred.
So the arrest has to come shortly after the search that's allegedly incident to that arrest.
Absolutely. It better be quick.
Let me ask you one other factual question because I don't fully understand this. The wallet is apparently under a chest.
Yes, sir.
The wallet is picked up by the officer. The officer says he's going to look in the wallet to see if there's identification. Apparently, Mr. Sykes said there was identification in the wallet. He opens up the wallet. Does he have to go through pockets in the wallet to find the cocaine, or is it something that falls out when he opens up the wallet?
It's unclear from the record. The record states that he opens up the wallet and then sees the contraband in it. No further information was elicited from either officer who testified at the motion hearing. So unfortunately, it's unclear from the record.
Apparently, the trial judge tied this to a plain view situation. So I came away with the impression, based on that determination, that it must have been something where he opened it up to find the identification, and there was the cocaine.
I think a reasonable view is that, one way or another, once he opens it up, whether it's in a typical tri-section wallet that most of us have, where it's stuck in there, or it's maybe a billfold of some type where you open it up and there's just a couple large sections, it's readily apparent, and that's how he took it.
All right, thank you.
Mr. De La Rosa, what should the police officers have done, in your view? They're at this apartment. The manager of the apartment is there. The locksmith is there. Someone comes and knocks on the door and then walks away when the door isn't answered. Then they go and the door isn't answered. And then suddenly the woman appears and she talks about, you can't come in. What should the officers have done to be reasonable under the Constitution, in your view?
Well, I'll make two simple but not flippant statements. One, they should have done more. And second, they should have done a little less. They should have done more investigation and less seizure of people and their property. And I want to step back and say, first of all, it's proper for the police to have responded. And I'm not here to say that the police should have ignored the situation or be there and just watch. I mean, that's certainly not what I'm arguing. However, they did have various powers at their disposal that they could have used and didn't. One, they could have, with the vague information that they had, they could have ordered everyone to leave. Because the one thing they do have is knowledge that the people present aren't the renter. They're not Stacy Hudson. And say, everybody's got to go. Now.
I don't want to interrupt, but the facts here are when they tried to enter, when they entered, one of the people, in fact, the woman that answered the door, rushed into the bathroom and flushed the toilet, shut the door, flushed the toilet. Now, wouldn't that raise the suspicion that there was some drug activity? I mean, that's what went on. So when you say everybody leave, well, they didn't even have that opportunity because the person that answered the door just ran away, right? That's why I'm just saying that argument seems to fall let's say it isn't as the facts were presented to us.
Well, what I mean by that, not as once the officer steps into the threshold of the apartment, what I'm not saying is immediately step in, everybody out, but step in, see who's there, because it's, I think, pretty clear from the record that once the woman runs to the bathroom, some flushing sounds are heard, she comes out immediately. So at that point, without doing anything further, and in response to Justice Prosser's question, what could the police have done? They could have told everybody to leave. And if they didn't leave, then whoever didn't could have been arrested for obstructing. Okay. Now, the question of whether that would have been a lawful order is something different. But in terms of what the responses could have been. Second, ask everybody for their identification. Name, date of birth, run warrant checks on them. All of us are probably well aware of there are times where somebody gives a false name and the officer will return and say, well, your name didn't come back on file, indicating you've given me a false name, it doesn't exist. And then proceed and ask a few other questions, or better yet, do what Officer Cluck did when he first got there, which is just maintain the status quo. Stop everything, hold everybody there, detain temporarily because, let's be real, I mean, there's obviously some suspicious conduct going on.
Well, let me ask you about that, Mr. De La Rosa. In fact, I want to follow up on Justice Wilcox's question here. I know I'm uncomfortable about this court recognizing a probable cause only type search, which is, I think, your position. But when we look at this record and we have the evidence of the flushing upon entry by the police officers, isn't this a different case? Couldn't we view this as, assuming we find probable cause for trespassing. Probable cause plus the exigent circumstance, the exigent circumstance being the potential destruction of evidence. Do we even need to get to extending this to a search incident to an arrest?
Yes, sir, I believe you do, because we're not talking about an automobile, which could be easily moved away. And when we talk about
probable cause... But you're talking about that flush.
I understand. But I think from a constitutional standpoint, there is a difference. And what you have is suspicious activity. Now,
but you don't need to have exigent circumstances only in automobile situations.
Yes, sir.
Right?
I understand, yes.
Okay.
But let's say this. By the time the officers have an opportunity to ID everybody, try to find out what's going on specifically in the apartment and specific to each individual, it's the flushing that has occurred. So the two factors that we have are people who aren't supposed to be there. And so
you would call them squatters.
I would call them squatters.
All right.
Okay.
But my issue, and I'm not nitpicking the officer's conduct, because they had authority and power and things they could have done very simply that wouldn't have taken a lot of time, that would not have subjected them to danger, to control the situation and find out specifically what each of the individuals was doing there, whether they had consent, whether they were going to lie about having consent, and then take appropriate action. Because if we look at what the appellate court ruled on, which was criminal trespass, and the elements for that is there has to be entry without consent, and second, that at that time of entry, there's a breach of peace. Well, the only information we have is from Ms. Hudson, who, after being badgered on the witness stand by the state and then subject to cross-examination, says, I talked to the landlord and I told them people shouldn't be there and wanted them out. And so what we're talking about really is enforcement by police officers of a private property right, which is acceptable because, of course, if somebody's supposed to be someplace or not be someplace more accurately, of course you want officer assistance to get those folks out. And if they're engaging in some type of criminal conduct, then make arrests as the officers see appropriate. But they weren't there to make arrests. They weren't even in the lengthy stage of investigation. I mean, asking somebody their name is basically the first step in conducting an investigation.
Joe LaRosa, I have to confess that I have been stopped for speeding in my life.
Welcome to the club, sir.
All right. My recollection is that when the officer came up to the car, he didn't ask my name. He asked for my identification. How is it different? And was I under arrest then?
I would say no. I think you're temporarily detained.
Okay. And were these people temporarily detained?
I think that's a question that hasn't yet been answered. I think the answer can be
well, yes. Didn't the first officer indicate that he went in and asked everyone to stay there and talk to them while he called for backup?
Sure.
Didn't he ask questions of them?
Unclear from the record.
Well, that's not what I think the testimony I read of the first officer was, that he asked some questions of why the people were there. But it's the second officer, or Lieutenant Horvath, I think it was.
Right.
He basically asked for identification.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Mr. Sykes indicated, under the cedar chest there in the wallet. How is this different from that unfortunate time when I got a speeding ticket?
Well, for the simple reason that if you had been stopped, would it have been acceptable for the officer to pull you out of the vehicle, grab your wallet from your coat or pants pocket? Or if it had been sitting in the seat in your car, would it have been appropriate for the officer to go around to the passenger side and pick the wallet out of your vehicle and open it up and take out your identification?
Well,
it's the difference between acquiring identification through a search and seizure not authorized by the Constitution and asking you for your consent to view your identification after you've given it to the officer. And that's the problem I have, which is the officer and the state in its argument wants to put the cart before the horse and then say that, well, not even that, but we really don't even need the cart. And I...
What
I don't understand is if I'm stopped in an automobile and they ask me for identification and I pull it out, that's one thing. In this case, it wasn't in the man's pocket. He says, I have identification. It's under there, under the cedar chest.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, that suggests to me that the officer is being told to go and get it.
And my response would be that the officer didn't ask to open the wallet, which I think is constitutionally necessary. As I've stated in my pleadings, consent. You have to ask to get it.
You're arguing that what he did was an acquiescence to a show of force from the officer. Are you arguing Schneckloth?
I think it could be considered that. You know, it's difficult because we don't have Mr. Sykes' testimony at the motion hearing. We do have the officer's testimony.
Let me back you up again, Mr. De La Rosa, because you argued, and I know it was argued in the briefs, and I know the positions have changed from the trial court to the Court of Appeals and how this search was upheld. But you talked about the elements of criminal trespass. You may have the misfortune of having a trial judge sitting in front of you now who dealt in misdemeanor court for a period of time. But I refer you to Section 943.15 of the Wisconsin statutes. Whoever enters the locked or posted construction site or the locked and enclosed building, dwelling, or room of another without the consent of the owner or person in lawful possession of the premises is guilty of a Class A misdemeanor. Now, if you have people who are sitting in the premises of the person in lawful possession and she doesn't want them there and she calls the police to ask them to leave, does the statute not control?
And I'm sorry, Justice, I missed the last portion of your question. If you
does the statute not control a situation where a person in lawful possession of premises doesn't want someone in their premises and wants them out, and they have reported those facts to the police? Or it was reported to the police, as I understand it, from the landlord. Isn't this what we're talking about here? Forget the elements of burglary. Forget criminal trespass to dwelling. Aren't we talking about entry into a locked building or locked dwelling? And if that's what we're talking about, if we find that there's probable cause, then the question becomes, do you need exigent circumstances, and do we have it here?
And my answer is no, because the statute itself speaks about entry. According to the testimony that we have in the record, the entry was done supposedly with the permission of this Tom individual who gives Mr. Sykes a key. We've moved from a violation at the time of entry into what can we do now that the person has stayed over the period of consent and whether that's criminal conduct. And I think with the vague details we don't have enough information to fulfill this particular statute. And that's the problem, which is if we're going to deal with just probable cause to arrest and that's sufficient to do a full-blown search of somebody, then we've strayed far from the search incident to arrest, because then the underlying rationale, if you want to call them exigent circumstances, don't exist, and there's no reason for the search.
Well, but that's where the flushing comes in, doesn't it?
Sure, that's an indication of some suspicious activity.
Where you may already have probable cause that there's an offense committed, because you have to look at what the police officers know, do you not? So if you look at what the police officers know when they go into the premises, and they know that there's somebody there that's not supposed to be there, and then when they try to knock on the door, the person runs and flushes the toilet. Maybe I'm missing something.
No, you're not. But the question is whether, okay, let's assume probable cause is there, for argument's sake.
Probable cause of what?
I'm sorry?
Probable cause of what?
Of criminal trespass or some type of drug offense, because that's what we're talking about.
Well, it can be both.
Sure.
So the
sure.
Flushing could be, now, if you... You hear a flush, does that give you probable cause to think that there are drugs?
No.
Okay.
No, the officers needed to have found out more information because the two facts, again, that we have are flushing and people not there.
Okay. Now, so let's move to criminal trespass. On pages 25 to 27, you indicate there isn't enough for probable cause for trespass. Do the officers have to have in mind criminal trespass or some other misdemeanor or crime when they're going to do a search incident to arrest? Isn't that what the big fight is between you and the state? The state thinks that that there's an objective test, namely, was there probable cause? Even if the officers had no idea that there was probable cause, if I understood the state, and we'll let Mr. Kleinmeier argue for himself, they're saying, hey, if there's probable cause to arrest, regardless of subjective intent of the officer can make a search incident to the arrest, right?
Sure.
Is that their argument?
It would seem to be. And I think it misleads us.
And what's your argument?
My argument is the officer's articulation as to what he thinks is occurring, meaning what crime, matters. Mm-hmm. Because only when you're going to have a custodial arrest can you then have grounds for a search incident to arrest. That's the threshold and that's the nexus. We can't.
What do you base that on? Subjective intent or knowledge?
I don't think Swanson does that. I think Swanson asks an objective question. Was an arrest implied, attempted, or accomplished? And in speaking about the officer's subjective knowledge or intent, it talks about a reasonable view of the officer's knowledge. So I don't think when the state argues that Swanson is in conflict with Wren, Sullivan, and McGill, that that's true. I think we're all on the same page. We just have the state of law that doesn't reach as far as the state wants. Because if you're not going to have a custodial arrest, and from an objective view of the evidence, the officers aren't communicating that by words or actions, and the defendant doesn't think that, then the underlying justifications allowing the search incident to arrest don't come into play. There's no reason for it, no necessity for the search. And then it's constitutionally impermissible. Because then if there's no arrest that's going to occur, there isn't a danger that the person is going to use a weapon, that they're going to hide evidence, or that they're going to use some instrument of escape. And those are the specific justifications for a search incident to arrest. You can't ignore it. So even assuming probable cause exists, that doesn't get you to a search incident to arrest. You have to ask the question now, because I guess we're allowing searches to precede arrests, was an arrest going to occur based upon a view of the whole scene?
And does it have to be an arrest for which there was probable cause before the search? So an arrest for trespass and a charge of trespass? Or is it enough to say, well, the officer could have arrested for trespass or some other misdemeanor, found the cocaine, arrested and charged. Ultimately, the charge was for possession of cocaine with intent to deliver. So what's your position? You've got to make an arrest for the trespass?
I think if there is probable cause to arrest for more than one offense, it can be done. But the question
arrest
is,
for the offense you didn't have probable cause for before the search. Is that your position?
Correct. Correct.
And what's the matter with this case?
Well, I think there's two problems. One, if you don't have probable cause, then there was no reason for arrest.
Right.
But
right.
Second, even if you did have probable cause to arrest, the fact that no arrest, I think objectively looking at the full scenario, at the time that the wallet is searched, the reasonable view is that there wasn't going to be an arrest because there wasn't enough information. There was only the vague information from the renter. That's why the search is unconstitutional, because no arrest was imminent.
Mr. De La Rosa, it's my impression, and correct me if I'm wrong, that in many cases where officers observe a misdemeanor, they don't actually arrest someone at that time. They get identification and they send follow-up paperwork. If you arrest someone, don't you have to take them to the jail? Put them in? It would seem to me, in a sense, that if there's probable cause for a misdemeanor or maybe an ordinance violation, you don't send someone to walk away, but you get identification and see if it's possible to simply proceed on paper rather than by arrest.
That's true. I mean, I'm not talking about that there's no right to ask for identification, but you have to ask for it if you're going to enter somebody's private piece and a personal property. And the best way to think about it is this way, is we have multiple layers of law that exist, municipal level law, state and federal, and misdemeanor and felony types. So if we buy the state's argument that probable cause to arrest allows a full search incident to that probable cause, then you can be driving 1 mile over the speed limit, be stopped, and the officer could decide not to issue you a citation, to do nothing to you, but stop you, search you, in the hopes that he finds something. And I think his motivation is somewhat irrelevant. But do a full body search, and maybe search the interior compartment of your car, in the hopes of finding evidence. And according to the state, that's constitutionally permissible. And I don't think that follows our search incident to arrest doctrine. So it exposes everyone to a wide range of intrusive conduct. And in your for your particular question, let's assume that somebody doesn't even receive a pink ticket, which we often see, at least in my county. Somebody issues them an officer issues a pink citation that has an appearance date in circuit court, and they have to appear at a certain date. The cop lets them go. No having to post bond at that time. And then once they get to court, a formal criminal complaint is issued. The case proceeds forward. In the state's view, we're moving from custodial arrest being the grounds for a search incident to arrest, and that's okay to do a full search, to having probable cause, not ever intending to make any type of arrest, or any type of arrest is going to occur, and you can still do the full search, even though none of the implications underlying the search incident to arrest doctrine are there. And that's problematic, because we're now straying far afield from the search incident to arrest doctrine. That's what we have here. So in the instance, what you're talking about is a violation, a personal violation of privacy rights when no exigent circumstances or underlying causations are there. And that supposedly is okay. And I think from a constitutional standpoint, it isn't. I see that my time is up. Unless there are other questions, I will step down.
Thank you, Mr. De La Rosa. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General Stephen W. Kleinmeier, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Yes, just for the record, repeat that. My name is, may it please the court, my name is Stephen Kleinmeier, Assistant Attorney General, appearing for the state, the plaintiff respondent. I would just like to start, again, by to focus, to get back to the issue that was stated in the petition for review for this case, and then work from that. And the question was, if probable cause to arrest exists, is the mere existence of probable cause a sufficient basis for a search incident to a subsequent arrest, where the arrest only occurs based on the evidence seized during the search?
And what's your answer?
The answer is yes, as long as the arrest is made shortly after the search, and as long as the officer had probable cause to arrest for something prior to the search.
Even if there was no subjective intent to make an arrest?
Correct. And so I think frequently get asked if by writing opinion, how do I want to be written? And I think that the conclusion that this court should reach is that for a search incident to arrest to be valid when it occurs before the arrest, then that's valid as long as prior to the search the officer has probable cause to make an arrest and the arrest follows shortly after the arrest. And that, I think, is merely a restatement of the law as stated in Rawlings versus Kentucky. In this case, the Court of Appeals found that standard was satisfied because they felt that the officer had probable cause to arrest at least for criminal trespassing or some trespass type offense, and that the arrest did follow shortly after or immediately after the search.
Mr. Kleinmeier, aren't you really arguing for an extension of Rawlings? You don't have an arrest here for the probable cause that the police had. In fact, police never arrested this individual for trespassing.
Well, actually, Your Honor, it's not clear what the arrest was for, because at the suppression hearing, the officer never testified what the arrest was for. At page 39, the suppression hearing, the question was, what happened then? I opened the wallet, looked for identification, and immediately found a baggie that I pulled out, believed to be crack cocaine. Question, was his license also in there? Answer, yes, it was. Question, now at this point, did you place the defendant under arrest? Answer, yes, I did. And I think that's all there is as to with the reason. So he didn't.
But he was charged with a drug offense.
Yes.
So I think it's probably safe to assume that he was arrested for a drug offense. You don't have the arrest, at least there's nothing in the record to indicate that there was an arrest for trespassing. So isn't what you're arguing for a new standard that's between search incident to arrest and a probable cause with exigent circumstances? Aren't you really arguing for a probable cause only standard?
No, Your Honor, because, again, I think it meets the same test as Rawlings, because there is probable cause to arrest before the search, and the search follows closely after the arrest follows closely after the search. And we have cited in our brief a series of cases from other jurisdictions which consider the same issue and found that even though the defendant in those cases was arrested, it's a similar situation in that prior to the search, the officer had probable cause to arrest for some offense. There was a search, and then the defendant was arrested and charged based on the evidence found in the search. So, I mean, those courts have also just taken that same approach. And in doing so, some of them at least, have cited Wren and Sullivan in those cases for an objective test. In fact, a similar situation, a lot of times I think you could look at examine this as far as the validity, just eliminate the search. Because we have cases, and Swanson is one, which indicates that the validity of the search incident to arrest depends on the validity of the arrest. And we have cases, we cited some more of those in the briefs, and there's particularly one from Wisconsin, which says the arrest is valid as long as even if the officer didn't know he had probable cause, as long as he had it prior to the arrest. And that was the Baudhine. I have to spell it because I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right. It's Baudhuin. I say Baudhine, and I'm not sure that's right. And there the officer stopped the car because he wanted to see if the driver was having a problem, it was a mechanical problem. And the court upheld the stop on the ground that he had reasonable grounds to stop for impeding traffic, a traffic offense. So, and they pointed out there that the officer's authority is not limited by what he happens to have in mind, by his subjective intent. It's limited by the information available to him, whether he satisfies the probable cause test.
Counsel, let me take that a step further, as your opposing counsel suggests, and that is I'm driving 6 miles an hour over the limit. I'm stopped. There would be, arguably, probable cause for the arrest. Under your interpretation, does that then mean there can be a full search of me and the car?
In traffic offenses, I must admit, is that the question came up, and I have to look at it more closely again. Then we're getting to Knowles versus Iowa, possibly, where I'm thinking there was a traffic stop and it was not an arrest, but there was a search, and they said, well, we could do the search because the law says we could have arrested. But in that situation, the court said, without the arrest, since it's a traffic stop, all those policies of why you allow searches incident to arrest don't apply, because a traffic stop is usually not the kind of thing that gets people concerned about defending themselves with weapons or destroying evidence. Knowles, I think we have to factor that in somehow in a traffic stop.
Why should a traffic stop be different than this case? There's no arrest, no indication that they're going to make an arrest, and they're just going to search. Isn't the policy the same?
Well, I think here it's different because in the Hart case, the court talked about, as I recall, the underlying reasons for a search incident to arrest is that the person, even if it's a not serious crime, the person may have to be concerned about the person taking violent action or destroying evidence, because the person may think that, yeah, I'm being arrested for something insignificant, but they're going to find out about me on something else. And in this kind of case, I think that applies too, where they can investigate why these people are in this place when they're not supposed to be. And the officer, there was the flushing of the toilet. The officer said there had been reports of people in and out of this apartment frequently.
Now look, as to violent action, did they search him personally?
Not up until finding the item in the wallet, no.
Right. So they might have been able to pat him down to look for weapons, right?
Right.
Okay, but they didn't.
So.
Well, actually, Your Honor, I can't say they didn't, but the record doesn't say one way or another.
So, okay. Trial court found that this was all pat down. The Court of Appeals didn't buy that. So they didn't pat him down. So now they're, as to the destruction of evidence, one, he didn't flush the toilet, apparently. And two, they've got him, so he's not going to flush anything or do anything. So, and he makes no move to destroy evidence. So what's happening here?
Well, Your Honor, for a search incident, in the Robinson case, for an officer to do a search incident to arrest, the officer doesn't have to justify in each case that the policy, that the reasons for the search incident to arrest, he was aware of them in those cases. They say the blanket rule in Robinson that if a search incident to arrest, he can just do a full search incident. You don't have to justify it in each case.
But there was no arrest yet.
No, but again, under Rawlings versus Kentucky, the arrest can follow the search if it follows it immediately. And again, in Hart, Hart distinguished a case in a footnote. They distinguished Mata. Because in Hart, the problem for the state was that the officer, before doing the search, told the defendant he was not going to be arrested. There was no arrest. The court, and they said, therefore, all these underlying reasons for search and arrest wouldn't apply because there would be no reason for the defendant to be concerned. They distinguished Mata, which was a case where they found that the search was incident to the arrest, even though the search preceded the arrest, because in that case, the officer was continuing the investigation, had never communicated any decision not to arrest. He was continuing the investigation up to finding the drugs. And immediately after finding the drugs, then he arrested the person. This case is like that. This investigation was continued. The first officer said he was investigating this to think about trespass, could be possible burglary. And so they were detained there, and he asked questions. This Officer Horvath came, talked to the first officer, and then continued with asking questions, which he said he was looking for identification during the investigation. So this case is much more like that Mata case, which was distinguished in the footnote, where this is proceeding. In other words, the defendant, for all he knows, he's going to be arrested. He doesn't know that he's off the hook.
I have a couple of problems. One, these cases just are hard to line up. You can make all these distinctions among them. Two, here you've got a guy in an apartment that's not his apartment. And although your brief at various points makes reference to reasonable expectation of privacy, what is the reasonable expectation of privacy in your personal property that's in somebody else's apartment?
Well, in the
living room under a cedar chest.
I never emphasized that in the brief because in the Whitrock case, which as I recall the facts, that was also people in an apartment where they weren't supposed to be. And one of the things the police did was seize, I think, a piece of stereo equipment or something. And the court said it was okay there, I think I'm right on this, because the defendant never expressed his ownership of that item. Well, here, although the defendant didn't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the apartment as found by the trial court, he did express ownership in the wallet because he said, there's my wallet over there. So I think in the wallet, because of what he said there, he had the expectation of privacy.
Now, I sort of was just following you along and saying, my goodness, the state is right, until I got to page 19 and 20 of your brief where you say, whoops, this seems to be a U.S. Supreme Court case pending that has, might have bearing here. If all of this is so clear, how come they took that case?
Well, that case is
an odd case. It's an odd case. It's a 1983. I recognize that.
Yeah, and it's not exactly, it's not exactly the same issue. I mean, that was the question there about a search incident to arrest. It's just the validity of arrest. And as I recall, the question there was the officer arrested the person, told him the arrest was for one offense, and it was found that the court decided later there was no probable cause for that offense. There was probable cause for a different offense. And I think, I can't remember now, in this particular case, I think that the federal courts decided, there's a split in the federal courts on that. Some federal courts say if the officer identifies the wrong crime, the arrest is valid as long as there's probable cause for any crime. Other federal courts say if the officer identifies the wrong crime, the arrest is valid as long as he has probable cause for, I think it's a related crime or something along those terms. And it's, I think they're addressing that split.
Your brief says the Court of Appeals found that the arrest was invalid because the offense for which the officer had probable cause was not closely related to the offense for which the arrest was made and for which the officer didn't have probable cause. So now if the court would, U.S. Supreme Court would say the arrest was invalid here because it was an arrest for criminal trespass is not closely related to possessing cocaine with the intent to distribute, what happens to your case?
Well, I think we'd have to see how they write the case. I mean, because there's several issues there, and I cited that because, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen. I became aware of it, and I think it could have an effect on this case. But I can't, you know, if they came out and said, which the state is, I mean, the police officers in that case are arguing, they want to just plain objective test. They're citing Wren, as I recall, and those kind of cases, saying as long as there's probable cause for anything, the rest is okay. I think if they go that way, then that clearly supports our argument. If they go a different way, I guess I would say I'd have to see how they reason and how they get there to see how closely it relates to this case.
But if I could take you back to Wren and the State versus Gower, because I'm concerned that you're over-arguing those cases and the meaning of those cases in Arkansas versus Sullivan. As I recall the facts of Wren, didn't that involve a case where you had some suspicion that the car was in a high-drug area, there might be something going on, but the officers actually observed a traffic violation when they attempted to pull the vehicle over. The vehicle took off. They eventually stopped the vehicle, and when they looked inside, the offender had cracked in plain view in his open hands. And I know a lot of the language that dealt with Wren dealt with a situation where you actually have a violation of the law that was observed by the officers, and he was validly stopped for that violation. Now, maybe they really wanted to look at something else, but that really doesn't matter because they had him for that which they observed. State versus Gallerup was a situation, as I recall, where you had a vehicle that was observed committing a traffic violation, and the officers pulled the vehicle over and got consent from the owner to search the vehicle. Arkansas versus Sullivan, as I recall, was a case where the state Supreme Court said, we're going to view the U.S. Supreme Court decision more broadly than they did. So I'm not sure what you're arguing in terms of Wren and Sullivan and Gallerup go as far as you say they do.
Well, I'm citing them for the idea, look, well, in Wren also the court said, you know, Fourth Amendment's reasonableness when you have probable, and if you have probable cause, most of the time, and I think it applies here, that's enough. You can act on that. So in this case, I'm saying here the officers had probable cause, the argument is for trespass. So therefore, you don't look at these extra factors in Swanson, which go to questions of pretext and the officer's intent.
That gets to my question. In Wren, the officers had probable cause for the traffic stop. In Gallerup, the officers had probable cause for the traffic stop. Here, arguably, the officers have probable cause for trespass, but that's not what he was arrested for. I think that goes back to the Chief's question.
I cited those cases more broadly, not for right on point. For cases more right on point, there's a whole series of cases we had from other federal court of appeals cases and state cases where, again, the probable cause before the search was for one crime. Then there was a search based on evidence found in the search. He was arrested for another crime. That's the kind of situation we have here. And I think at least some of those cases cite Wren just for the general proposition that you look the objective test, probable cause. If you've satisfied the objective test for probable cause, that's all you need for the first part of the search incident to arrest test, that you have to have probable cause before the arrest. So it doesn't have to be for the crime that the arrest was for. There's also a Seventh Circuit case, another case we've cited, saying you don't even have to tell the officer, the defendant, what the arrest is for. There's other cases cited, Koligman is one of them, it was brought up here, you know, just because he's arrested for a crime doesn't mean he has to be prosecuted for that. And one of the cases said, you know, if you do like what the defendant here is asking for, what you're asking the police to do is pile on charges, name every conceivable offense that it could be arrested for, so that you avoid any of this question later on. So that's why I think it comes back to the general proposition of Wren and them, that objective test for probable cause, if you satisfy that test as the first part of the search incident to arrest test, you satisfy it. It doesn't make any difference what crime it's for.
Mr. Kleinmeier, if I could, also one last question, maybe hopefully last question. Let me ask the same question I asked Mr. De La Rosa. Do we even need to get to search incident to arrest here? I mean, assuming we agree with you that there's probable cause, whether it be for trespass, whether it be for burglary, whether it be for entry into locked dwelling, once we get there and we have the female who answered the door flushing upon sight of the police running into the bathroom, slamming the door shut, flushing and coming right out, couldn't we find exigent circumstances there? And couldn't this be viewed as a probable cause slash exigent circumstance case?
I guess my hesitancy, and I'd like to jump on that and say yes, but usually to say there's probable cause for criminal trespass, the probable cause part is criminal trespass. The exigent circumstances, when you hear toilet flushing, you think drugs.
That's what you find when you get there.
Yeah, but normally the probable cause and exigent circumstances, there's a little more of a connection between the crime for which you have probable cause for and the exigent circumstance. Now, there's some reference that the Court of Appeals, indicates that, you know, that there might have been probable cause for the drug offense because the officer testified, Officer Horbath testified, that even before he got there, he heard reports of people in and out frequently.
That would be a stretch, though.
Pardon?
That would be a stretch.
Yeah, I think putting that even with the flushing, I think it's higher. I mean, the Court of Appeals said might be probable cause. It's obviously reasonable suspicion, but I think it's hard to make probable cause out of that combination.
Counsel, I want to return to the question I asked before, because I asked about a car stop 6 miles over, and you went into Knowles and said car stops are different. Well, you know, I know that car stops are different. The constitutional reasonableness for traffic stops vis-a-vis the Fourth Amendment, in my opinion, seems a little more flexible. But that gets to my point. If it isn't lawful in a traffic stop where there's greater flexibility for the state in interpreting constitutional reasonableness, how can it be lawful in an apartment? That's my question. 6 miles over for speeding. Under the current law of traffic stops, are you entitled, is the state entitled to do a full search of me and the vehicle for probable cause for 6 miles over a traffic stop?
I think Knowles versus Iowa says no if there's not an actual, if there's not a custodial arrest.
Okay, so if you can't even do it in a traffic stop, how can you do it in an apartment? That is, probable cause for something entitles you to full search for anything.
Because you still have, and explained in Hart, you still have the underlying concerns that justify a search incident to arrest even after the arrest. The concern that the person will think he's going to be arrested, and therefore take violent action.
Let me take, since you did not jump on when given the opportunity, Justice Butler's exigent circumstances. So let's take, and that fact actually bothers me, the flushing of a toilet. You know, that's not because there are mineral deposits accumulating around the tank, you know. But let's take that out, because that's not legally relevant here. We're not dealing with exigent circumstances. So take out of the fact situation the flushing of the toilet. Is this a lawful search without that?
Yes, because there's the probable cause for the trespass or the trespass type of
offense. Okay, so probable cause for anything means that you can search everything. Is that right?
Well, with the exception of the possible exception of Knowles, which I hadn't thought about a whole lot before coming here, so I'm trying to answer off the top of my head, yes, I agree with you.
Full search of anything, if you have
full search of everything if you have probable cause for anything.
Well, I guess I'm not quite sure what you mean by everything. You couldn't search
my body, the whole apartment.
No,
that's what
no, definitely not the whole apartment. Search incident to arrest is much more controlled than the whole apartment. But you can do the search, the limit of the search that's permitted is a search incident to arrest.
What's that?
The area, I think, is defined with an immediate, I think the term is the immediate control of defendant. So that basically the concern is places he could get too quickly, get too quickly to grab a weapon or destroy evidence.
Okay. And did that include where the wallet was found? Was not a weapon.
The record's not clear exactly how far the wallet was from him.
It was under a piece of furniture.
Right. But it doesn't say precisely how far away.
Mr. Kleinmeier, maybe I lied before when I said that was the last question. you've argued in your brief that opening the wallet relegated this to a plain view type situation. But isn't this controlled by Arizona versus Hicks? How do you get to plain view? And Arizona versus Hicks is where they had to move the stereo equipment around to look at the serial numbers, and the United States Supreme Court said you can't do that. That's a search. Well, opening the wallet is pretty much the same thing, isn't it?
Well, if it's a search incident to arrest, and you're entitled to do the search, that's a full search. It's a full search incident to arrest, so you can check the wallet.
But you argued plain view, and I'm dealing with the plain view aspect of your argument. I mean, I can understand why you're arguing search incident to an arrest. I don't really see how this can be a plain view search.
Yeah, and now that you pointed out that way, I probably shouldn't have bothered. It was probably an argument I carried over from the Court of Appeals and didn't think through properly. Yeah, it was a full search. It is a full search in response to Justice Bradley's question. A search and arrest is a full search within the scope I've allowed. And once you get there, then you're right. It wouldn't be limited. As I think back, the argument where I made the plain view was in connection to a consent to search for identification and said looking for that. Then we could, although I think of it, there was a question earlier about where the drugs were found in the wallet. I don't think there's information at the suppression hearing that says that.
The preliminary
hearing, which I think is document 4, page 8, it says this is the middle of page 8, I opened the wallet to get the driver's license. Okay, what did you find, if anything, in the wallet? In the main portion where one would normally hold his paper currency, I found a plastic baggie. And so it was apparently just opening up the main portion of the wallet, and he could find it right away. But, I mean, that's, to my knowledge, the extent to which we know where it was found.
But he had to open up that packet or pocket of the wallet. Didn't fall out of the wallet.
No.
Say, here I am.
No, but, I mean, it is the main portion of the wallet, probably. But that's where it happened.
Before or after he found the ID?
I think the way it is, I think that's before. He says, was there anything else found in the wallet? There, I did pull out, and right now I don't know if it's a driver's license or Wisconsin photo ID or some other cards that had his name on it. So from this, it appears that the first opened the wallet, the first thing he saw was the baggies. And then he looked and he's found the ID, either a driver's license or a photo ID. He couldn't remember which, but one of those IDs.
Mr. Kleinmeier, how many people were in the apartment when the officers arrived?
I think there's reference to the defendant and two females, three people.
And one of the females came to the door.
Correct.
And what did she say when the officer wanted to come in?
Her response was, no, you can't come in, my man's naked, or something like that, I think was her reason for trying to keep him out.
Is that true?
No, the officer testified. He couldn't remember what he was wearing, but the defendant was dressed, was wearing something.
Is that obstruction?
Well, since considering that the officers had both consent and to enter from the landlord and that there was no reasonable expectation of privacy, maybe just trying to keep them out might have been obstruction. Pushing the door in their face.
Yeah, but that would have been of the woman, not the man that ultimately.
Yes, that's
seized.
True.
So there wasn't probable cause for him.
Well, could I ask, it seems to me there were three people there who shouldn't have been in the apartment, and we know what happened to one of them. Does the record indicate what happened to the other two of them?
somewhere, and now I can't remember where in the record, I saw a reference that one of the women was arrested on a warrant, was taken on a warrant that was out for her. The other woman, I don't recall, I don't remember anything in reference to her. And I apologize, I can't remember where I saw in the record about the one woman, but I think it's in there somewhere.
Was that known to the officers at the time, that there was a warrant outstanding?
I don't believe that it says whether prior to getting Mr. Sykes' identification that they knew that. I don't recall. I don't think it specifies that.
Mr. Kleinmeier, are you asking that we specifically overrule the Swanson decision?
Yes, I think the two parts of that should be modified, overruled, whichever term used, but those are more specifically in Swanson, 164 Wisconsin 2nd, page 452, the court there says, we require that the state show that an actual arrest took place for something other than possession of a controlled substance. This requirement will help ensure the police do not arbitrarily violate an individual's privacy. And it's that latter language, I think, indicates this rule, particular requirement was aimed at preventing pretextual searches. But there they say it has to, the arrest, the officer has to make an arrest for a crime other than what they find during the search. And our argument is as long as they have probable cause for arrest before the search for any offense, then the arrest and search is valid. Also, there's also language near the bottom of page 453 where it says the state has failed to show that an arrest for anything other than possession of a controlled substance was ever implied, attempted, or accomplished by the police officers in this case. And what the officer intended as far as or was thinking of in terms of a possible arrest, I think that goes to the officer's subjective intent. And I don't think that that should be a part of the validity of the – that doesn't go to probable cause. It doesn't go to whether the arrest occurred. Therefore, I don't think it should be a part of the test. And again, in our brief, we think we cited some cases where the officer's belief about whether he was going to make an arrest should not be considered.
Well, you think Swanson was right for Swanson?
At the time, it may well have been because, as I said, I think these extra requirements were put in to because they were concerned about pretextual arrests and searches. That was kind of a developing area of the law. I mean, but by the time we get to Wren, I think, as according to Lefebvre points out, Wren has ended any discussion. There is no such thing as a pretextual search when the action is based on probable cause. Now, if you're talking about, they point out, administrative searches, inventory searches, that's a different matter because you're acting, police act without probable cause.
How do you get Wren and Knowles together? How do they fit?
Well, Knowles was concerned mainly with justifying a search incident to arrest, and the court, that's my recollection is, they said in the traffic stop situation, the reasons you permit a search incident to arrest just don't apply to a traffic stop because there's not evidence. First of all, there's not evidence to look for in a traffic stop. And there's because of persons usually just given a ticket and they're on their way, the individual is not going to be concerned. Or, you know, there's not the risk, not the same risk that the individual is going to grab a weapon and fight back.
Wren was a traffic stop.
Mm-hmm. But the question, they weren't concerned, the search incident to arrest was not the issue in Wren. The defendant wanted the court to recognize pretextual searches and say we're not going to permit any evidence to be admitted if it's a pretextual search. And so it's a different issue, different emphasis in Wren. They didn't discuss search incident to arrest at all in Wren.
Yet you're relying on Wren. And it's
relying on its general propositions that you don't look at the officer's subjective intent, and that when you have matters that are the police action, where police action is justified on probable cause, you look only at the probable cause, not the officer's subjective intent.
Thank you, Mr. Kleinmeier. Mr. De La Rosa.
Thank you. To get back to basics, the main focus of this case isn't probable cause. Probable cause is relevant to our discussion. But the real issue is, at the time of the search of the wallet, was an arrest of Mr. Sykes going to have been made? Right at that moment. That's the question that we have to ask today, because Swanson requires us to ask that question. And it requires us to ask that question because the search incident to arrest doctrine has never been based merely on the existence of probable cause. Now, Rawlings doesn't necessarily discuss an arrest being imminent or having taken place, but Rawlings doesn't come out and announce, hey, this is the big rule in this case, this is big black-letter law that you now only have to have merely the existence of probable cause. And that's important because if we follow the state's logic and reasoning, then you can never challenge a search incident to arrest. You can never challenge the search occurring. You can only then challenge the scope of the search, whether it was reasonable. Not even if you could do it. And that puts us in a brand new world because we're talking about a massive shift in power. Freedom and liberty is power. It's a shield that envelops every single person in our state, regardless of invocation, regardless of knowledge of the existence. If we move to having just probable cause to arrest be the grounds to do a full incident search of somebody, you have a massive shift in power over to police. And what I'm asking the court today, to do today is not to do that, and it doesn't rob the state and police officers of any power they already have. The state is not put at a disadvantage by reversing the appellate court's decision today. The police are in no worse position than they were prior to the day Mr. Sykes was arrested. And if we take a look at what an officer articulates, okay, when an officer articulates the proper crime for which he could have arrested an individual, for which he had probable cause, the question is, did he articulate in some form or fashion that an arrest was imminent and likely? Because it is only then that you get into the underlying justifications for a search incident to arrest. If we look at Cubb versus Murphy, and that was a situation where there was a long investigation taking place over a month, and the police didn't arrest until well after the investigation had been going on, the defendant knew of the investigation, and the officers did a limited search in that instance. The court in Cubb, as was stated in Swanson, the Cubb court nevertheless determined that the taking of the evidence was constitutionally permissible under the particular circumstances of that case because the suspect was sufficiently aware that an arrest was imminent. So if you're going to have a search that precedes an arrest, you better have, from an objective standpoint, you better have the conclusion that an arrest was going to occur. Otherwise, there's no need for the arrest. The underlying justifications of weaponry, protecting evidence, protecting instruments of escape, doesn't come into play. Just doesn't come into play.
Your position here is there's nothing showing that the arrest was going to occur.
Correct. Because of what both the officers articulated at the motion hearing, that they were there in a community caretaker function, why the landlord called, why he wanted them there, the possibility of people being in the apartment, not even knowledge that there would people be there, but the possibility, just in a safeguarding capacity. There's no indication that they were there for an investigative or criminal enforcement purpose.
So you're going with Swanson. We require that the state should show that an arrest actually took place for something other than possession of a controlled substance. This requirement will help ensure the police do not arbitrarily violate an individual's privacy. Formal arrest gives an accused the opportunity to exercise his or her Miranda rights and imposes a duty on police officers to apprise the arrestee of those rights and respect the arrestee's use of those rights.
Correct. The rule I'm requesting promotes good law enforcement, promotes accurate law enforcement, and it promotes proper step-by-step investigation. And not investigation to eliminate all possibilities of lawful conduct, but at least do a sufficient minimal amount of investigation where you're sure you have specific information about a specific target, a specific individual, that that individual is doing some type of wrongdoing.
This case is almost precisely on the fact situations of your case.
Correct.
Swanson is. There was a detention. The court held he was not under arrest, and then the court said he's not under arrest, never was arrested, didn't intend to be arrested, ultimately was charged with the drug violation, which they found when they did the search.
Correct. In my opinion, Swanson is a necessary response to Rawlings to just to remind us, to give us the poke, that you can't forget about arrest. That arrest is an important threshold moment where so many things flip. You have the right to attorneys, Miranda, lots of constitutional protections that exist, and the situation changes once an arrest has taken place.
Let me ask, Mr. Kleinmeier indicated that his recollection was that one of the women was arrested on a warrant. Suppose they asked for her identification and she gave some identification, and then they found out from that she was wanted on a warrant. How does that relate to what we're talking about here? Is that abusive?
If they had placed her under arrest and then conducted a search, given the warrant.
Well, suppose they didn't place her under arrest. They simply asked for her identification, and they found out when they got the identification by following up that she was wanted on a warrant. And they didn't arrest her first.
Right. I think that's a little different situation, and I think the reasonable view is they're going to arrest her, you know, based upon the warrant. So I think from a constitutional standpoint, if the search precedes the arrest, I think the police would probably have been in okay territory. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. DeRosa. Thank you, Mr. Kleinmeier, for another argument on the Fourth Amendment, which continues to be an unresolved riddle. That concludes our hearing on 03-1234 Sierra State versus Sykes. We're going to take a few moments of recess so that the students may leave if they wish, and another group of students may come in.